Iskar Alpast's love was pure and perfect, except that his wife kept getting in the way. When he leaned left, she leaned right. When he leaned right, she leaned left. When he stretched his neck, she stretched hers, and all he could see was the mangled net of her tangled hair, and beneath that those steely black eyes, too knowing for her own good, and for his too, come to that. "The foolish hag," he muttered. "Can't she see I'm leaning this way and that and bobbing up and down only because I feel like it, and not because the High Priestess is over there amply presenting her deliciously ample backside? Knowing well, yes, she does, how I squirm and drool, pant and palpitate, the temptress, the willful vixen? But no, every angle and this horrid nemesis heaves into view, damning my eyes. Maybe I can cleverly send her off on an errand. Now there's an idea." He smiled and leaned forward, all the armour of his charm trembling and creaking in the face of the onslaught of her baleful stare. "Sweet raisin, crumpet, the mule needs grooming and tender care in the temple stables." "Does it now?" "Yes, and since you're clearly not busy with anything at the moment, you could instead do something useful." "But I am doing something useful, dearest husband." "Oh, and what's that, tender trollop?" "Why, I am sacrificing my time to keep you from making a bigger fool of yourself than is normal, which is quite a challenge, I assure you." "What stupidity is she talking about? Love, oyster, whatever are you talking about?" "She's made her concession that you are who you claim to be, and that's the only thing keeping her from tossing us both out on our scrawny behinds. You and me and the mule and the gibbering bocaral, assuming she can ever manage to get them out of the cellar. I'm a witch of the spider goddess, and the High Priestess back there is not at all happy about that. So I'm telling you, oh rotted apple of my eye, if I let you try and jump her, we're all done for." "She talks so much, it's a wonder her teeth don't fall out. But wait, most of them already have. Shh, don't laugh, don't even smile." "Am I smiling?" "Maybe, but it's the indulgent kind, the kind that means well, or if not well, then nothing at all. Though wives the world over, when seeing it, go into apoplectic rage for no reason at all. The cute, lovable dear is." He sighed and leaned back, trying to peer under her right armpit, but the peripheral vision thing turned that into a hairy nightmare. Flinching, he sighed again and rubbed at his eyes. "Go on, wife. The mule is pining, and your sweet face is all he longs for. To kick. Hee-hee! Shh! Don't laugh. Don't even smile." He looked up. "Delicious wrinkled date. Why not take a walk out into the sunshine in the streets? The gutters, more like, ha! The runnels of runny sewage. Take a bath. Piss up one of those lampposts, and not a dog in Darujistan would dare the challenge. Ha! But this smile is the caring kind, yes. See?" The High Priestess Sordiko Kwam cavorted up to where they sat. This woman didn't walk. She went as much sideways as forward, a snake of seduction, an enchantress of nonchalance. Gods, a man could die just watching. Was that a whimper escaping him? Of course not. More likely Morgora's armpit coming up for air made that gasping, squelching sound.
"I would be most pleased,"
the High Priestess said in that well-deep voice that purred like every temptation imaginable, all blended into one steaming stew of invitation,
"if you two indulged in mutual suicide."
"I could fake mine," Iskar Alpast whispered. "Then she'd be out of our way. I know, High Priestess of all my fantasies, I can see how you wage war against your natural desires, your blazing hunger to get your hands on me. Oh, I know I'm not as handsome as some people, but I have power."
Sighing, Sordiko Kwam cavorted away. But no, from behind it was more a saunter. Approaching was a cavort, leaving was a saunter.
"Sordiko saunter Kwam cavort. She comes and goes, but never quite leaves. My love of loves, my better love than that excuse for love I once thought was real love, but let's face it, love it wasn't. Not like this love. Why, this love is the big kind, the swollen kind, the towering kind, the rutting, gasping, pumping, exploding kind. Ooh, I hurt myself."
Morgora snorted.
"You wouldn't know real love if it bit you in the face. Keep that armpit away from me, woman." You've turned this temple into a madhouse, Iskarel Pust. You turn every temple you live in into a madhouse. So here we are, contemplating mutual murder, and what does your god want from us? Why, nothing. Nothing but waiting, always waiting. Bah! I'm going shopping. At last! Iskarel crowed. And you're coming with me to carry my purchases. Not a chance. Use the mule. Stand up or I'll have my way with you right here. In the holy vestry? Are you insane? Ratting blasphemy! Will Shadow Throne be pleased? Fine. Shopping, then. Only no leash this time. Then don't get lost. I wasn't lost, you water buffalo. I was escaping. I'd better get the leash again. And I'll get my knife!
Oh, how marriage got in the way of love. The bonds of mutual contempt drawn tight until the victims squeal. But is it in pain or pleasure? Is there a difference? But that is a question not to be asked of married folk. Oh, no. And in the stables the mule winks at the horse, and the horse feels breakfast twisting in her gut, and the flies, well, they fly from one lump of dung to another, convinced that each is different from the last, fickle creatures that they are. And there is no wisdom among the fickle, only longing and frustration, and the buzz invites the next dubious conquest, smelling so fragrant in the damp straw. Buzz, buzz. Amidst masses of granite and feverish folds of bedrock veined with glittering streaks, the mining operation owned by Humble Measure was an enormous pit facing a cliff gouged with caves and tunnels. Situated equidistant between Darujistan and Gredfall and Annex, and linked by solid raised roads, the mine and its town-sized settlement had a population of 800. Indentured workers, slaves, prisoners, work chiefs, security guards, cooks, carpenters, potters, rope makers, clothes makers and menders, charcoal makers, cutters and nurses, butchers and bakers. The enterprise seethed with activity. Smoke filled the air. Old women with bleeding hands clambered through the heaps of tailings, collecting shreds of slag and low-quality chunks of coal. Gulls and crows danced round these rag-clad, hunched figures. Not a single tree was left standing anywhere within half a league of the mine. Down on a slope on the lakeside was a humped cemetery in which sat a few hundred shallow graves. The water just offshore was lifeless and stained red, with a muddy bottom bright orange in colour. Scented cloth held to his face, Gorlas Vidicus observed the operation which he now managed, although perhaps managed was the wrong word. The day-to-day necessities were the responsibility of the camp workmaster, a scarred and pock-faced man in his 50s with decades-old scraps of raw metal still embedded in his hands. He hacked out a cough after every 10 words or so and spat thick yellow mucus down between his bronze-capped boots.
"The young'uns go the fastest, of course."
Cough, spit.
"Our moles, or so we call them. Since they can squeeze into cracks no grown-up can get through."
Cough, spit.
"And this way, if there's bad air, it's none of our stronger workers get killed."
Cough.
"We was having trouble getting enough young'uns for a time there, until we started buying them from the poorer families both in and out of the city. They got too many runts to feed, you see, and we got special rules for the young'uns. Nobody gets their hands on them, if you know what I mean. From them, it goes on up. A miner lasts maybe 5 years, barring falls and the like. When they get too sick, we move them out of the tunnels, make them shift captains. A few might get old enough for foreman. I was one of them, you see. Got my hands dirty as a lad, and here I am, and if that's not freedom, I don't know what is, eh?"
This workmaster, Gorlas Vidicus silently predicted, would be dead inside 3 years. "Any trouble with the prisoners?" he asked.
"Nah, most don't live long enough to cause trouble. We make 'em work the deadlier veins. It's the arsenic what kills 'em, mostly. We're pulling gold out, too, you know. Profit's gone up 3,000% in the past year. In my share, I'm looking at maybe buying a small estate."
Gorlas glanced across at this odious creature.
"You married?"
Cough, spit.
Not yet,
and he grinned.
But you know what a rich man can buy, hey?
As part of what I am sure will be an exceptional relationship, Gorlas said, where I profit from your work, I am prepared to finance you on such an estate. A modest down payment on your part, at low interest.
Really? Why, noble sir, that would be fine. Yes-y, very fine. We can do that, all right.
And when you kick off with no heirs, I acquire yet another property in the estate district. It is my pleasure, he said with a smile. Those of us who have done well in our lives need to help each other whenever we can.
My thoughts, too, about all that. My thoughts exactly.
Smoke and stenches, voices ringing through dust, oxen lowing as they strained with overloaded wagons. Gorlas Vidicus and the dying workmaster looked down on the scene, feeling very pleased with themselves. Harlow squirmed his way out from the fissure, the hand holding the candle stretched out in front of him, and felt a calloused grip wrap round his narrow wrist. The candle was taken, and then Bainisk was pulling Harlow out, surprisingly tender, but that was Bainisk, a wise veteran all of 16 years old, half his face a streak of shiny scar tissue through which peered the glittering blue of his eyes, both of which had miraculously escaped damage. He was grinning now as he helped Harlow onto his feet.
Well, Mole? Iron, raw and cold and wide across as three of my hands laid flat. The air? I'm here, aren't I?
Laughing, Bainisk slapped him on the back.
You've earned the afternoon. Back to Chuffs you go.
Harlow frowned.
Please, can't I stay on here?
Venna's giving you more trouble.
Bullies don't like me,
Harlow said.
That's 'cause you're smart. Now listen, I warned him off once already, and once is all the warning I give, and he knows that, so he won't be bothering you. We need our moles happy and in one piece. It's a camp law. I'm in charge of Chuffs, right?
Harlow nodded.
Only you won't be there, will you? Not this afternoon.
Venaz is in the kitchen today. It'll be all right.
Nodding, Harlow collected his small sack of gear, which was a little heavier than usual, and set out for Upside. He liked the tunnels, at least when the air wasn't foul and burning his throat. Surrounded by so much solid stone made him feel safe, protected, and he loved most those narrowest of cracks that only he could get through, or the few others like him, still fit with no broken bones and still small enough. He'd only cracked one finger so far, and that was on his right hand, which he used to hold the candle and not much else. He could pull himself along with his left, his half-naked body slick with sweat despite the damp stone and the trickles of icy water. Exploring places no one had ever seen before, or dragging the thick, snaking hoses down into the icy pools, then calling out for the men on the pumps to get started, and in the candle's fitful flickering light he'd watch the water level descend and see, sometimes, the strange growths on the stone, and in the crevices the tiny blind fish that, if he could reach, he slid into his mouth and chewed and swallowed, so taking something of this underworld into himself. And, just like those fish, at times he didn't even need his eyes, only his probing fingers, the taste and smell of the air and stone, the echoes of water droplets, and the click-click of the white roaches skittering away. Earlier this morning he'd been sent down a crevasse, ropes tied to his ankles as he was lowered like a dead weight, down, down, three, then four knots of rope, before his outstretched hands found warm, dry rock. And here, so far below ground, the air was hot and sulphurous, and the candle, when he lit it, flared in a cross-flow of sweet, rich air. In the yellow light he looked round and saw, sitting up against a wall of the crevasse not 3 paces away, a corpse. Desiccated, the face collapsed and the eye sockets shrunken holes. Both legs were shattered, clearly from a fall, the shards sticking through the leathery skin. Furs drawn up like a blanket, and within reach of one motionless skeletal hand was a rotted bag now split open, revealing two antler picks, a bone punch, and a groundstone mallet. A miner, Harlow realized, just like him, a miner of long, long ago. Another step closer, eyes on those wonderful tools which he'd like to take, and the corpse spoke.
As you please, cub.
Harlow lunged backward, his heart pounded wild in the cage of his chest.
The demon!
Patron of miners, perhaps. Not a demon, cub. Not a demon.
The candle had gone out with Harlow's panicked retreat. The corpse's voice, sonorous with a rhythm like waves on a sandy beach, echoed out from the pitch-black darkness.
I am Devad Anantol, of the Irinthal clan of the Imas, who once lived on the shores of the Jagratil, until the tyrant race came to enslave us, sent us down into the rock where we all died. Yet see, I did not die. Alone of all my kin, I did not die.
Harlow shakily fumbled with the candle, forcing the oiled wick into the spring spark tube. Three quick hissing pumps of the sparker and flame darted up.
Nice trick, that.
The tube's got blue gas, not much, and runs out fast, so it needs refilling. There's bladders upside. Why didn't you die?
I have had some time to ponder that question, cub. I have reached but one conclusion that explains my condition. The ritual of Telan.
What made the evil Tlani Mas? I heard about that from Uncle Gruntle. Undead warriors at Black Coral. Gruntle saw them with his own eyes, and they kneeled, and all their pain was taken from them by a man who then died. Since there was so much pain, he took from them, and so they built a barrow, and it's still there, and Gruntle said he wept. But I don't believe that, because Gruntle is big and the best warrior in the whole world, and nothing could make him weep, nothing at all.
And Harlow had to stop then so that he could regain his breath, and still his heart hammered like hailstones on a tin roof. From the Imas named Devad Anantol, silence.
You still there?
Harlow asked.
Cub, take my tools. The first ever made, and by my own hand. I was an inventor. In my mind, ideas bred with such frenzy that I lived in a fever. At times, at night, I went half mad. So many thoughts, so many notions. My clan feared me. The Bonecaster feared me. Raist himself feared me. And so he had me thrown down here to die, and my ideas with me.
Should I tell everyone about you? They might decide to lift you out so you can see the world again.
The world? That tiny flame you hold has shown me more of the world than I can comprehend. The sun, oh, the sun, that would destroy me, I think, to see it again.
We have metal picks now,
Harlow said.
Iron.
Sky stone. Yes, I saw much of it in the tunnels. The Jagat used sorcery to bring it forth and shape it. We were not permitted to witness such things. But I thought, even then, how it might be drawn free without magic, with heat, drawn out, given shape, made into useful things. Does Raist still rule?
Never heard of any Raist, said Harlow. Bainisk rules Chuffs and Workmaster rules the mine, and in the city there's a council of nobles, and in faraway lands there are kings and queens and emperors and empresses.
And Tlani Mas who kneel.
Harlow glanced up the shaft. He could hear faint voices echoing down.
They want to pull me back up. What should I tell them about this place?
The wrong rock, the white grit that sickens people, foul air.
So no one else comes down here?
Yes.
But then you'll be alone again?
Yes. Tell them, too, that a ghost haunts this place. Show them the ghost's magical tools.
I will. Listen, could be I might sneak back down here if you like.
Cub, that would be most welcome.
Can I bring you anything?
Yes.
What?
Splints.
And now Harlow was making his way back to daylight, and in his extra-heavy bag there clunked the tools of the corpse, antler and bone hardened into stone, tines jabbing at his hip. If Venaz found out about them, he might take them, so Harlow knew he had to be careful. He had to hide them somewhere, where nobody went or looked or picked through things. Plenty to think about, he had. And he needed to find something called splints, whatever they were. She insisted on taking his arm as they walked towards the Phoenix Inn, down from the estate district, through third-tier wall, and into the Daru district.
So many people, she was saying. This is by far the biggest city I've ever been in. I think what strikes me is how many familiar faces I see. Not people I actually know, just people who look like people I've known.
Dyker thought about that and then nodded.
The world is like that, aye.
Is it now? Why?
I have no idea, Selara.
Is this all the wisdom you can offer?
I even struggled with that one, he replied.
All right, let's try something else. I take it you see no point in history.
He grunted.
If by that you mean that there is no progress, that even the notion of progress is a delusion, and that history is nothing more than a host of lessons nobody wants to pay attention to, then yes, there is no point. Not in writing it down, not in teaching it.
Never mind, then. You choose.
Choose what?
Something to talk about.
I don't think I can. Nothing comes to mind, Selara. Well, I suppose I'd like to know about Heborik.
He was losing his mind. We were trying to get to Ototaral Island, where he wanted to give something back, something he once stole. But we never made it, ambushed by T'lani Mas. They were going after him, and the rest of us just got in the way. Me, Cutter, Grey Frog. Well, they also stole Felicin Younger. That seemed to be part of the plan, too.
Felicin Younger.
That's the name Shaik gave her.
Do you know why?
She shook her head.
I liked her, though.
Shaik?
Felicin Younger. I was training her to be just like me, so it's no wonder I liked her.
And she gave him a wide smile. Dyker answered with a faint one of his own. Hard indeed to be miserable around this woman. Better if he avoided her company in the future.
Why the Phoenix Inn, Selara?
As I said earlier, I want to embarrass someone. Cutter, in fact. I had to listen to him for months and months about how wonderful Darujistan is and how he would show me this and that. Then as soon as we arrive, he ducks away, wanting nothing to do with us. Back to his old friends, I suppose.
She was being offhand, but Dyker sensed the underlying hurt. Perhaps she and Cutter had been more than just companions.
Instead, he said, you found us Malazans.
Oh, we could have done much worse.
Barathol had kin, said Dyker, in the bridge burners, an assassin. Seeing your friend was like seeing a ghost. For Picker, Ansi, Blend, Blue Pearl, the old Marines.
One of those familiar faces belonging to someone you don't know.
He smiled again.
Yes. Oh, yes, Selara, you are clever indeed.
And before you know it, some old Marine healer is out doing whatever he can to help Barathol Mekar. Only there's this history, the stuff that doesn't matter, with our blacksmith friend. Having to do with Aran and the...
Red Blades, aye.
She shot him a look.
You knew?
We all know. The poor bastard. Getting such a raw deal in his own homeland. Things like that, well, we can sympathize with because we have our histories. The kind that can't be ignored because they've put us right where we are. Right here, a continent away from our home.
progress?
That remains to be seen. And here we are, Phoenix Inn. She stood studying the decrepit sign for a long moment.
That's it? It's a dump.
If the story is accurate, Kalam Mekar himself went in there once or twice. So did Sori, who later took the name of Apsala. And that was where young Crocus met her, who is now known as Cutter, right? Putting it all together isn't easy. Mallet was there for most of that. In there, he added, you might even find a man named Krupper. She snorted.
Cutter talked about him. Some oily fence and ex-thief.
Ambassador at large during the Panion War. The man who stood down Caladan Brood, single-handedly confounding most of the great leaders on the continent. Her eyes had widened slightly.
Really? All that? Cutter never mentioned any of that.
He wouldn't have known, Selhara. He went off with Fiddler, Kalam, and Apsala.
That's a tale I'm slowly putting together myself, she said. Apsalar, the woman Cutter loves. Ah. Let's go then.
And they set out across the street.
The kid's been snatched, is my guess, Murillo concluded, settling back in his chair. I know, Crupper. It's one of those things that just happens. Tanners grab children, trader ships, fishing crews, pimps and temples, they all do, given the chance. So I know there may not be much hope.
Nonsense, Murillo, loyal friend of Crupper. In appealing to this round self, you have displayed utmost wisdom. Moreover, Crupper applauds this new profession of yours. Instructor, yes, in all fine points of fine pointiness. The art of dueling is writ bold in blood, yes. Bold, too, is this Stony Menakis, old partner to none other than Gruntle of the Barbs. And was there not a third? A long-armed man who did not return from Capustan? And was his name not Harlow? Crupper must plumb deeper depths of memory to be certain of such details, yet his instinct cries out true. And how can such a voice be denied?
Cutter rubbed at the bristle on his chin.
I could head back down to the ship I came in on, Murillo. Talk to the dock waifs and the old women under the piers.
I'd appreciate that, Cutter.
Crupper suspects a whispery warming of heart in dear Murillo for his new employer. Ah, does Crupper flinch at vehement expostulation? Does he wince at savage denial? Why, the answer is no to both.
Leave off that, Crupper, Murillo said. The lad's her son.
Left in the care of others? Is she so cold of heart, then? Do you rise to extraordinary challenge, mayhap? The best kind, of course, ever the best kind.
There's a story there, Murillo said. Not all women make good mothers, true enough. But she doesn't seem that kind. I mean, well, she struck me as someone with fierce loyalties, maybe. Oh, I don't know. It'd be nice to find the runt, that's all.
We understand, Murillo, Cutter said. Rely upon Crupper, dearest friend. All truths will yield themselves in the fullness of revelatory revelation anon. But wait, fortuitous reunion of another sort beckons.
And he leaned forward, small eyes fixing upon Cutter. Eyebrows waggled.
You're scaring me. Terror shall burgeon imminently for poor Cutter. What are you?
A hand settled on his shoulder, soft, plump. Cutter closed his eyes and said,
I've got to stop sitting with my back to the door.
Murillo rose, suddenly formal, as he bowed to someone standing behind Cutter.
Historian, we have met once, or...
I recall, the man replied, moving round into Cutter's sight as he collected two chairs from a nearby table.
Thank the gods, not his hand.
Please do thank Mallet again.
I will, the historian replied.
In the meantime, I'm not the one who should be doing the introductions.
Those weary ancient eyes fixed on Cutter.
You're Cutter, yes?
He twisted to look at the woman standing behind his chair. Seated as he was, his eyes were level with a pair of breasts covered in tight-fitting linen.
and he knew them well. It was a struggle to lift his gaze higher.
Silara, you call that an introduction? She asked, dragging up the other chair the historian had pulled close.
She wedged herself in on Cutter's right and sat down.
I've never seen bones picked so clean on a plate before, she observed, her eyes on the leavings of lunch.
Crupper wheezed upright. He began waving his hands.
Crupper hastens with proper welcome to this grand company, to already beloved Silara of the knowing eyes, and other assorted accoutrements of charm Crupper would dearly wish to knowingly eye, if not for the dastardly demands of decorum. Welcome, cries Crupper, even as he slumps back, oof, exhausted by his enthusiasm and dimpled with desire.
Murillo bowed to Silara.
I won't be as crass as dimpled Crupper. I am Murillo, an old friend of Cutter's.
She began repacking her pipe with rust leaf.
Cutter spoke often of your charm, Murillo, when it comes to women.
And she paused to smile. Murillo sat back down a tad hard, and Cutter saw, wryly amused, that he looked more awake now than he had in days, perhaps since the stabbing. Crupper was fanning his flushed face. Then he raised a hand.
Salty, sweet creature, the finest wine in the house. No, wait. Go down the street to the Peacock and buy us a bottle of their finest wine. The finest wine in their house, yes. Is something wrong, Meese? Crupper meant no insult, honest. Salty, be on with you, child. Meese, why...
No more, cut in Murillo. Unless you want to pile on ever more insults to our faithful proprietor, until she comes over here and kills you outright.
Dire misunderstanding, enthusiasm, and...
Dimples, we know.
Cutter spoke up.
Silara was a camp follower in Shaikh's rebel city in Uraruku. Not a follower like that, I mean.
Yes, I was, she said. Just that.
She struck sparks to the bowl.
Plaything to soldiers, in particular Malazans, renegades from Corbolo Dom's turncoat army, his dog slayers. I was then plucked from what would have been a short, benumbed existence by a Malazan priest with no hands, who dragged me across half of seven cities along with Cutter here.
She sent a stream of smoke upward, then continued.
Just inland of the Ototaral Sea, we got jumped. The priest was cut down. Cutter got disemboweled, and I had a baby. No real connection between the two, by the way, apart from bad timing. Some villagers found us and saved us. The son of Oserk showed up for that. And that's how we collected Barathal Mekar and Char, making up for the two we'd lost in the ambush. Now, normally I don't tell long-winded tales like this one. But what I gave you was necessary for you to understand a few important things. One, I left the baby in the village with no regrets. Two, Cutter, who was with us because the rope thought Felicin Younger needed protecting, nearly died and is now living with a feeling of having failed at his task since Felicin was taken from us. Three, Cutter also has a broken heart. And no matter how much fun we eventually had, him and me, it's clear that I can't help him with that. And finally, four, he's embarrassed by me because he probably thinks I'm too fat, and he thinks you'll all be thinking the same thing, too.
All three men facing her fervently shook their heads at that, while Cutter sat head in hands. Salty arrived to slam down a thick-based, dusty clay bottle and two more goblets.
Three councils, Crupper.
Crupper set three silver coins into her hand without a whimper. After a long moment, the historian sighed, reached out and uncorked the bottle. He sniffed the mouth, brows lifted.
Empty the rubbish in your cups, please.
They did, and Dyker poured.
Cutter, said Murillo.
What?
You were disemboweled? Gods below, man.
Crupper struggles to taste the wonder of this wondrous vintage, so ghasted a flabber is he at said horrendous tale. The world is most cruel, yet salvation unfolds at the last. Blessed be all the gods, goddesses, spirits, marsupials, and amphibians, and indeed all the rest. Made drunk by punches is poor Crupper. Rocked this way, knocked that, buffeted askew in every direction at once, very nearly unto exploding. Beloved Silara, you tell a most awkward tale, and tell it badly. Despite this, see us here, each one reeling at said poorly told revelations.
Perhaps excessive in my efforts at summarizing, I'll grant you, Silara allowed. But I thought best to push through the uncomfortable stage, and now here we are, relaxed and eager to quaff down this fine wine. I have decided I like the Phoenix Inn.
Dyker rose.
My task complete, I shall...
Sit back down, old man, she said. If I have to slap the life back into you, I will. Less painful, one hopes, partaking of our company this day, don't you think?
The historian slowly sat back down. Crupper gusted out a sigh.
Pity us men at this table. We are outnumbered.
I take it Cutter's told nothing, Silara observed. Not even how we almost drowned when the moon broke up and fell out of the sky, saved by a dragon.
I will indeed stay, said Dyker. Provided you back up and tell us all this properly, Silara.
As you like.
From the moment you first met Heberic.
This will take all night, she said, and I'm hungry.
Murillo will be delighted to purchase our suppers, declared Crupper.
For once you are right, Murillo said.
I don't think you're too fat, said Cutter. I don't think anything like that, Silara.
Too good, yes. And why don't you see how Barathol looks at you? As for me, well, Apsalar was smart enough to get away, and I won't begrudge her that. In fact, I doubt there's a woman low enough for me anywhere in the world. Was that too self-pitying? No, just realistic, he decided. Oh, and by the way, everyone, that dragon is wearing silks and biding her time aboard her damned ship, right there in Darujistan Harbor. Oh, and did I mention that the city is in imminent danger?
The bottle of wine was done, and Salty was sent off for another one.
Meese was quickly appeased by the orders for supper and the knowledge that eventually the swill she stocked would be broached and consumed to excess, as Silara told her tale. While Cutter's mind, sodden with alcohol, wandered through all those thoughts that were anything but self-pitying.
Not a woman anywhere.
Lady Chalice Vidicus sat at one end of the table, Shardan Lim on her left, Hanot Orr to her right. For this night she wore emerald-green silks, the short coat tight-fitting, collarless to expose her unadorned powdered throat, and low-cut to reveal her scented breasts. Her hair was tied up, speared through with silver pins. Rouge blushed her cheeks, kohl thickened her lashes, earrings depended from her ears in tumbling, glittering array, the green of emerald and the blue of sapphire. The coat's short sleeves revealed her bared arms, the skin soft, smooth, slightly plump, unstained by the sun. Leggings of brushed kid leather covered her lower limbs, and on her feet was the latest style of sandals, the one with a high peg-like heel. Amber wine glimmered in crystal goblets. Candlelight painted soft and gold every detail in a pool that faded into gloom beyond the three at the table, so that the servants moved in shadows, appearing only to clear dishes, rearrange settings, and deliver yet more food. She but picked at her meal, wanting to be somewhat drunk for what would come at the end of this night. The only question she was unable to answer was, "Which one first?" Oh, there was sexual excitement. She could not deny that. Both men were hale and attractive, though in very different ways, and both equally obnoxious, but she thought she could live with that. For certain, her heart would play no role in what was to come. No giving over, no confusion that might lead to conflicted feelings, or feelings of any sort. She could keep this simple. Everyone made use of what they had, didn't they? Especially when what they had proved desirable to others. This was how power accrued, after all. One man here, right or left, would have her this night. Had they already decided which one between them?
a toss of the knuckles, a wager in flesh. She was not sure. The evening was early yet, and thus far she'd seen no overt signs of competition. Hannot spoke. "Chardon and I have been discussing you all afternoon, Lady Chalice."
"Oh, how flattering."
"It was on the night of my uncle's murder, wasn't it? At Lady Simtal's estate. You were there."
"I was, yes, Hannot."
"That night, young Gorlas Vidicus saved your life."
"Yes."
"And so won your heart," said Chardon Lim, smiling behind his goblet as he sipped.
"You make it sound an easy thing," she said, "winning my heart."
"Then gratitude made a good start," Chardon observed as Hannot settled back as if willing to listen and venture nothing else, at least for now. "He was very young, as were you. An age when charms seemed to flash blindingly bright."
"And I was dazzled," she said.
"Gorlas did very well by it, I should say. One hopes he daily expresses his gratitude. When he is here, I mean. All the proper, entirely unambiguous gestures and the like."
Hannot Orr stirred. "For too long, Lady Vidicus, the House of Orr and the House of Dahl have been at odds on the council. Generations of that, and as far as I am concerned, for no good reason. I find myself wishing often that your father would meet me to make amends, to forge something new and lasting, an alliance, in fact."
"An ambitious goal, Hannot Orr," said Chalice. "Unfortunately, my father thinks you are a preening, fatuous ass. A true Orr, in other words. And you are most welcome, I'm sure, to make such an overture. I wish you the lady's tug."
"Ah, then I have your blessing in such an endeavour?"
"Of course. Will that impress my father? That remains to be seen."
"Surely he cherishes you dearly," Chardon Lim murmured. "How could he not?"
"I have this list. The House of Vidicus was ever a modest presence in the council," she said. "A long, unbroken succession of weak men and women, singularly lacking in ambition."
Hannot Orr snorted and reached for his goblet.
"Excepting the latest, of course."
"Of course. My point is, my father ascribes little weight to the desires of House Vidicus, and I am now part of that house."
"Do you chafe?" She fixed her gaze on Chardon Lim.
"A bold question, sir."
"My apologies, Lady Vidicus. Yet I have come to cherish you, and so only wish you happiness and contentment."
"Why would you imagine I felt otherwise?"
"Because," Hannot Orr drawled, "you've been knocking back the wine this night like a tavern harlot." And he rose. "Thank you, Lady Vidicus, for a most enjoyable evening. I must, alas, take my leave."
Struggling against anger, she managed a nod. "Of course, Councillor Orr. Forgive me if I do not see you out."
He smiled.
"Easily done, m'lady."
When he was gone, Chardon swore softly under his breath.
"He was angry with you."
"Oh?"
The hand that raised the goblet to her lips was, she saw, trembling.
"Hannot wants your father to come to him, not the other way round. He won't be a squirming pup to anyone."
"A pup is never strong enough to make the first move, Chardon Lim. He misunderstood my challenge."
"Because it implies a present failing on his part, a failing of his nerve."
"Perhaps it does, and that should make him angry with me? How precisely does that work?"
Chardon Lim laughed, and as he stretched out, it was clear that, free now of Hannot Orr's shadow, he was like a deadly flower opening to the night.
"You showed him up for the self-important but weak-willed bully that he is."
"Unkind words for your friend."
Chardon Lim stared down at his goblet as he drank a mouthful. Then he said in a growl,
"Hannot Orr is no friend of mine."
The wine was making her brain feel strangely loose, untethered. She no longer even tasted each sip. There had been so many of them, the servant a silent ghost slipping in to refill her goblet.
"I think he believes otherwise."
"I doubt it. It was some damned conspiracy with House Orr that saw my father assassinated. And now it seems my family is snared, trapped, and the games just go on and on." This was a most unexpected side of the man, and she did not know how to respond to it.
"Such honesty humbles me, Chardin Lim. For what it is worth, I will keep what I have heard this night to myself."
"No need, but thank you anyway. In fact, I'd rather your husband well understood how things stand. Hanot Orr is a dangerous man. House Lim and House Vidicus share many things, principal among them the stigma of disrespect on the council. Contempt, even. I have been curious," and now the look he turned upon her was sharp, searching. "This venture of your husband's, ever pushing for this ironmonger of his to attain membership in the council, what does Gorlas play at?" She blinked in confusion.
"I'm sorry, I have no idea."
"Might you find out, for me?"
"I am not sure if I can. Gorlas does not confide in me on such matters."
"Does he confide in you at all?" he went on without waiting for her reply, not that she had one. "Lady Vidicus, Chalice, he is wasting you, do you understand? I see this. Gods, it leaves me furious. You are an intelligent woman, a beautiful woman, and he treats you like one of these silver plates. Just one more possession, one more piece in his hoard."
She set her goblet down. "What do you want from me, Chardin Lim? Is this some sort of invitation? A conspiracy of love? Trysts behind my husband's back? While he travels here and there, you and I meeting up in some squalid inn? Getting intimate with each other's bodies, then lying back and making pointless plans, endlessly lying to each other about a future together?"
He stared across at her. All the servants had, with uncharacteristic discreetness, vanished into the side chambers, the kitchens, anywhere but this dining room. Even the wine server had disappeared. It occurred to Chalice that Chardin's manservant had probably been free with coin among the house staff, and that sly, silent man was now outside in the courtyard, passing a pipe to eager-eyed menials, and they were all laughing, snickering, rolling their eyes, and worse. Too late, she realized, to change any of that, to scour the lurid thoughts from their petty minds. "You describe," Chardin Lim finally said, "a most sordid arrangement, with all the cynicism of a veteran in such matters. And that I do not believe. You have been faithful, Chalice. I would not so care for you otherwise."
"Oh, have you been spying on me then?"
It was a mocking question that lost its carefree aura as the man voiced no denial, and she suddenly felt chilled to the bone.
"Following another man's wife around does not seem an honourable thing to do, Chardin Lim."
"Love has no honour."
"Love or obsession? Is it not your own hunger for possession that has you coveting a woman owned by another man?"
"He does not own you. That is my point, Chalice. Such notions of ownership are nothing but twisted lies disguised as love. I have no interest in owning you, nor in stealing you away. If I had, I would have found an excuse to duel your husband long ago, and I would have killed him without compunction, for you, to give you back your life."
"With you at the grieving widow's side? Oh, that would look odd now, wouldn't it? Me leaning on the arm of the man who murdered my husband? And you talk to me of freedom?"
She was, she realized, shocked sober. By what this man was revealing to her, by the stunning depth of his depraved desire. "Giving you back your life," I said.
"I will ask you again. What do you want?"
"To show you what it means to be free. To cut your chains. Take me to your bed if you so desire, or don't. Send me out of here with your boot to my backside. The choice is yours. I want you to feel your freedom, Chalice. In your soul, let it burn, bright or dark as you like, but let it burn, filling you entirely."
Her breaths came fast, shallow. Oh, this was a most unanticipated tactic of his.
Give me nothing, woman. No, give it to yourself instead. Make use of me as proof of your freedom. Tonight you can make yourself free again, the way it felt when you were younger, when there was no husband weighing down your arm, before the solemn shackles were slipped on.
A most extraordinary invitation indeed.
Where are my servants?
Away for the rest of the night, Lady Vidicus.
Just like Hannot Orr. Does he sit in some tavern right now, telling everyone?
I arranged nothing with that bastard, and you must realize he will talk whether anything happens or not, to wound you, your reputation.
My husband will then hear of it, even though nothing has happened.
And should you stand before Gorlas and deny the rumors, will he believe you, Chalice?
No, he wouldn't want to. He will not accept being cuckolded.
He will smile because he doesn't care, until it serves him to challenge one of us, me or Hannot, to a duel. On a point of honor, he is a fine duelist, a cruel one at that. He disregards all rules, all propriety. Victory is all that matters, and if that means flinging sand into his opponent's eyes, he will do just that. A very dangerous man, Chalice. I would not want to face him with rapiers bared, but I will if I have to. Then he shook his head. But it won't be me.
No.
It will be Hannot Orr. That is the man he wants for you. He's given you to Hannot Orr. Another reason he stormed off, since he finally understood that I would not permit it.
So in Gorlas's stead this night, you have defended my honor.
And failed, because Hannot is skewering your reputation even as we speak. When I said you can make use of me, Chalice, I meant it. Even now, here, you can tell me to seek out Hannot. Yes, I can guess where he is right now, and call him out. I can kill him for you.
My reputation
is already ruined, Lady Vidicus, and I am truly sorry for that. Tell me what you would have me do, please.
She was silent. It was getting difficult to think clearly. Consequences were crashing down like an avalanche, and she was buried, all air driven from her lungs. Buried, yes, in what had not even happened. Yet. I will try this freedom of yours, Shardan Lim.
He rose, one hand settling on the grip of his rapier. Milady.
Oh, how noble.
Snorting, she rose.
You've taken hold of the wrong weapon.
His eyes widened. Was the surprise real or feigned? Was there a glimmer of triumph in those blue, blue eyes? She couldn't find it at all, and that frightened her.
Shardan.
Milady.
Make no wishes for a future. Do you understand me?
I do.
I will not free my heart only to chain it anew.
Of course you won't. That would be madness.
She studied him a moment longer and received nothing new for that effort. I am glad I am not drunk, she said,
and he bowed, making in that one gesture this night of adultery so very noble. Night seeps into Darujistan, a thick, blinding fog in which people stumble or hide as they walk the alleys and streets. Some are drawn like moths to the lit areas and the welcoming eternal hiss of gas from the wrought iron poles. Others seek to move as one with the darkness, at least until some damned piece of crockery snaps underfoot or a pebble is sent skittering, and everywhere can be seen the small glitter of rodent eyes or heard the slither of tails. Light glows through shutters and bubbled glass windows, but never mind the light and all peaceful slumber and discourse and all the rest such illumination might reveal. Dull and witless the expectations so quickly and predictably surrendered. A woman in whose soul burned freedom black and blazing arches her back as only the second man in her life slides deep into her and something ignites in her mind,
Gorlas ever used his fingers in this place after all, and fingers cannot match gods below. But leave that now. Truly, imagination suffices to make eloquent all the clumsy shifting about and strange sounds, and the fumbling for this and that, and then that, no more. Out into the true darkness, yes, to the fingerless man stalking his next victim. To a new estate and Captain Torvald Nom of the House Guard, moments from leaving for the night with all security in the so capable hands of Scorch and Lef. Yes, he worked hard on that. Who pauses to watch a black two-person carriage trundle into the courtyard, and whose eyes thin to very most slits of suspicion and curiosity, and a niggling feeling of something, as a cloaked, hooded figure steps into view and slides like a bad thought up the stairs and into the main house. Who? Ponder no longer, Torvald Nom. On your way, yes, back home to your loving and suitably impressed wife. Think of nothing but that and that alone, and be on your way. A guard with occasional chest pains is questioning patrons of a bar, seeking witnesses who might have seen someone set out to follow that local man into the alley in order to beat him to death, and would no one step forward on behalf of that hapless victim? Might do, aye, if any of us liked him, you see. In a crypt, irrationally well lit, of course, sits a man plotting the downfall of the city, starting with a handful of Malazans, and he sits most contented in the absence of shadows or any other ambivalence imposed upon reality. Out in Chuffs, as moles sleep in their tiny cots, Bainisk sits down beside Harlow's bed to hear more stories about Darujistan, for Bainisk was born in Chuffs, and has never left it, you see, and his eyes glow as Harlow whispers about riches and all sorts of wonderful foods and great monuments and statues and blue fire everywhere, and before long both are asleep, Harlow in his lumpy bed and Bainisk on the floor beside it. And across the way, Venaz sees this and sneers to display his hatred of both Bainisk and Bainisk's new favourite, when Venaz used to be his best. But Bainisk was a betrayer, a liar, and worse, and some day Harlow would pay for that. Because Harlow was right. He was a boy who drew bullies like a lodestone, and this was a cruel fact, and his kind were legion, and it was a godly blessing how so many survived and grew up to wreak vengeance upon all those people not as smart as they were. But even that is a bitter reward, and never quite as satisfying as it might be. Back to Darujistan, with relief, as a great raven launches herself skyward from the tower of Baruch's estate, watched with evil satisfaction by a squat, overweight demon staring out from a spark-spitting chimney mouth. And this was a night like any other, a skein of expectations and anticipations, revelations and perturbations. Look around, look around! On all sides, day and night, light and dark, every step taken with the firm resolve to believe in the solid ground awaiting it. Every step, one after another, again and again, and no perilous ledge yawns ahead. Oh, no! Step and step now. Step and step.